Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing in life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet. That's where it is. Featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genre. Our new issue is just out. We've got Jamie Ford, author of Hotel at the Corner of Bitter and Sweet out there, as well as Carol Casella, who's just got Gemini, her third novel out, and Amy Hotfany. So it's a good lineup of three great authors. So you can find that at authormagazine.org. And we are also funded by the Great Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. They are taking, people are signing up now for their Summer Writers Conference in July, the SeaTac Hilton here in SeaTac. So if you're interested in that, head on over to pnwa.org. It's pnwa.org. You know, it's a funny thing. When we tell stories, say fictional stories, we often put our heroes and heroines through trials that we ourselves would never wish on our friends, certainly not on ourselves, but this is the stuff of good fiction. But it's true of memoir also. You know, when we write a story about our own life, we usually pick a portion of it that's the most challenging, perhaps the most dramatic, probably a moment where we ask the greatest questions of ourselves. And these make the best stories, even though while we're living them, we probably wish they weren't happening. And certainly, we would never choose ourselves the path that we walk that becomes the story we tell. It's probably true of today's guest, debut memoirist Maria Much, whose first book, Know the Night, just came out March 25th from Simon & Schuster. And it tells the story of a period in her life when her first son, Gabriel, who was born with Down syndrome, also eventually received the diagnosis of autism, and that weren't enough. He stopped sleeping for a period of time, and that meant she stopped sleeping too. And she describes this journey with Gabriel beautifully in her memoir, and I'm sure she wouldn't have wished it on herself, but boy, did it make for a good book. I'd like to talk to her right now, matter of fact, about that story. Maria, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. Hi, thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I don't talk about the weather on this show, not normally, but I know that you're speaking to me from my native Rhode Island, where I have understood there you've just lived through a very stubborn winter. Are the reports correct?
Oh, yes, indeed. They have not been exaggerated.
Well, I would not bring that up, except that it is relevant to your story, is it not? Stubborn is the right word, but winter strangely relates to this story, doesn't it? How is that so? Would you be willing to enlighten our audience a little bit?
Oh, absolutely, and it does. Because I didn't just tell the story of my situation with my son Gabriel. I also, as you know, fold in polar exploration, and in particular, Admiral Richard Byrd, who in 1934 had a stay in Antarctica. He had 55 men with him, and he went to stay away from them in a hut by himself implanted in the ice. And his idea was that he would stay for 6 months and take meteorological data. And he ended up surviving 4 months before he had to be rescued. And he wrote a book called Alone, that came out in 1938, and it was a bestseller at the time, but I had never heard of him when I came across his book, and I had just been sort of interested in polar exploration in general. And so when I picked up his book, I was really taken up with the isolation that he experienced and the fact that he was up at night, which, of course, related to my experience with Gabriel. And there were all kinds of differences between the two situations, and I thought that would make sort of an interesting story to sort of go back and forth between the two of them.
Yes, and it did. But I was just thinking about this today, or yesterday, I guess, when I was reading the book. I was imagining, because I always do this because I write, and I was imagining Maria at the moment when she said to herself, I know what I should do. I should link in this stuff with Bird. And some small part in her brain thinking, what are you doing? Why are you bringing... At least I would go through that at some point. I would think, am I trying to sabotage what is a simple story, or maybe not a simple story, about me and my son, and bring in this other completely different thing? Did you ever go through that with that choice? Because it's such an unusual choice. No.
Not at all, because a lot of my favorite essays, I read a lot of creative nonfiction, and I come from a poetry background. So, and there is that sort of, there's a little bit of a territory between, say, the poetic essay and creative nonfiction.
Absolutely.
And a lot of my favorite essays by, you know, Annie Dillard, Susan Griffin, Lawrence Weschler, Joan Didion, have several elements that are woven together, and the writer goes between them. So there was never a moment of doubt. And in terms of Bird, that was actually a really organic choice, because while Gabriel was experiencing his sleep disorder, and the worst of it occurred over about a two-year period, I read Bird's book, and it was something that had a really big effect on me. His style, and he had a ghostwriter as well, so between he and his ghostwriter, there is this wonderful, lyrical, elegant story that's also, it's a fabulous polar adventure story, and yet it's one where he's staying put. And it was just something that meant so much to me at the time, and I received some kind of solace from learning about his experience. So it was actually really natural to involve the story. But when I started out, I thought that maybe what I was really writing was a book of essays. And so one would be about Gabriel, and the next would be about Bird, another about jazz, because, of course, jazz is a big element in the book as well. But then I ended up, as I was working with the material and sort of going between those threads, it became sort of a more continuous narrative, and it eventually ended up at what it is.
Yeah. It's so funny that you were going to try it, because, you know, I had to do the same thing for this book I just finished, where I thought I had all these what seemed like very disparate things, and I thought maybe it's just a bunch of essays. And I tried it that way, and it didn't work either, and had to find the story finally. All right, so you had no fear about it with bringing the Admiral, the Bird stuff in. And so I assume that is, it has to be that on, and you kind of already hinted at it, you understood the value of that yourself as a reader, how much you love that as a reader. Is that what provides part of the fearlessness?
Yeah. Also, I thought that it was a great way to move beyond just Gabriel and me. It seemed like a very small story without the other elements. It seemed to me that there was something that I was after that was much bigger than Gabriel and I, that I really wanted to talk about general isolation and what language means. Because the neat thing about Bird's story, not neat from his part, but, as a reader, it's fascinating to see what happened to his communication. So when he was in the hut, for instance, he could only communicate with his men through Morse code, and he was lousy at Morse code. And as he became more and more ill, his messages became more garbled, and that was how his men figured out that he needed to be rescued. And what happened with Gabriel is that before his sleep disorder ever happened, he lost all of his language. So when he was a toddler, he spoke, and he had an 80-word signing vocabulary, and all of that disappeared. And at that time, we didn't have his autism diagnosis, so we didn't know what was going on, what was causing that. And the loss of his language was extremely difficult to experience, and it unfolded over a number of years, and it was a very mysterious occurrence to us. So when I was reading about Bird, there was just so many things in his story that were just too good to pass up.
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought you did. I do think that the best stories like this are become windows into the world beyond the characters in them. And it's very tempting with a book about a kid on the spectrum or with Down syndrome to make it about that. But to me, the best stories like this, that those, you, the character of you, the character of your son, become portals into something bigger, something more universal. which I felt you did a great job of in this.
Thank you. Yeah, there was something that really struck me when I looked at my very specific circumstance with my son. And it's not every day that you meet somebody who, you know, has Down syndrome and autism and happens to love jazz, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then I looked at Bird's situation, and of course, he's the only person who has ever done what he did. No one has ever replicated, you know, going and sitting in a hut in
right.
Antarctica for 4 months, because, you know, nobody would want to. So, you know, those are two very, very keenly specific instances,
yeah.
And yet there was this thread of just pure human isolation between them that was just really, really marvelous. And, of course, that comes out in jazz, too, because, you know, the story of jazz has so much about dissonance and dislocation and attempts at connection in it. So that became a good fit, too.
Well, and the writer in isolation, boy, if the writer doesn't know isolation, they may don't know writing, because it seems to me that you are – in some, I mean, Hemingway always called it the only the suicide, he said, was lonelier than the writer. That's his drama. But
yeah.
But I think it's true, though. You are in a self-imposed isolation when you go, even if you're working out in a cafe or something. I don't do that, but it seems
right.
to be. Does that make sense to you? That the connection where you have to go to write is,
oh, yeah.
is a place entirely within. No one else can go there.
That's right. That's right. And only you can do that work, and only you can tell your particular story. No one's going to do it for you. So, yes, it's very there is loneliness, maybe in a way, or maybe it's just, you know, being alone. And, of course, there are distinctions between those two, and that was another thread of exploration in the story as well.
Yeah. Yeah. At the beginning of the book, you talk a little bit about your writing experience. And I guess you had a particularly excruciating bout of what gets called writer's block. Now, you describe,
right.
and I'm going to quote you on this, but I'm going to have to get confirmation from you. You said at one point you had a seven-hour stint, I think seven was the number you listed, where
yep.
the only word that appeared on your screen was Jesus. Now, all right, now, when was that moment? I'm confused. When did that happen as relation to, like, right now? How long ago was that moment?
Oh, that was back in my 20s. So that I think I was pregnant with Gabriel at the time, so that would have been 96, 97.
Okay. All right. So writing clearly, though, has been... Well, so, like, for instance, when did you say to yourself, Maria, this is what I want. I actually want to see if I can make a living somehow as a writer. I'd like to actually go be a professional writer. When did that thought cross your mind?
Oh, I've wanted to be a writer since I was a kid. So when I was 10, I had a girlfriend, and we alternated chapters on a novel, and we completed it, and it was unfortunately I don't have it anymore, but I remember it vividly. We called it Stranded, and I remember drawing a cover for it and everything. And it was basically sort of a Lord of the Flies. We both had older sisters in high school, and I think they must have read Lord of the Flies in their English class and passed the basic story along to us, and we were horrified by it and sort of recreated something like that. So that was really. Really from childhood. And then, you know, through university, I have a degree in visual art, and that was actually great training for writing. I didn't really realize that at the time, but it ended up being very beneficial. But at the time, when I was in university, it didn't really occur to me to switch majors. I was there for painting, and I really, really just wanted to be a writer. And so when I left university, I was working on poetry, and I, you know, had poems published in literary journals and that sort of thing, and then eventually got pregnant with Gabriel, and had that really intense period of writer's block that was really, that was really about, I would say, a severe case of anxiety disorder.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, I was just thinking about that. I was giving a speech a couple of weeks ago to a bunch of writers, and I was talking about fear. And I really believe that that's really the only thing that stands between the writer and what they want to do. But the difference with writing is, you know, in your life, see if this resonates with you. In your life, you can blame your fear on, you could say, well, I'm afraid because my son has these challenges and what if, or I'm afraid because of Wall Street, or I'm afraid because there's a million things we can be afraid of. But when you sit down to write, really, the excuses are gone. There's just you and your thoughts, you and your belief about the past, you and your belief about the future. And it can really can come crushing in on you, I think. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think that in my case, I had a fundamental misunderstanding about creativity, which is that at that time when I was in my 20s, and I think this was partly because when I was going through university, and it was the late 80s, the sort of the Jack Kerouac method of writing was still, that still held a lot of sway, this idea that you didn't edit, that you were sort of a genius.
Really?
Right away.
In university? In college level? Really? Okay.
Yeah, I really did not understand the level of editing that is required or that is required for me. When I worked on Know the Night, I relished the editing, and I relished the beginning period where I just sort of put things down and really, really followed along with the notion of the bad first draft I wasn't bothered by it. When I was in my 20s, I didn't have that. I didn't make that connection. So it was, you know, I would trace the writer's block to a number of things, you know, the anxiety, but also just a general misunderstanding of how creativity works. But, you know, I got over that, so.
Yeah, well, obviously. And, you know, also, I thought it was interesting about this book was you let yourself take – so I'm going to double back a little bit. I found it interesting that you started from poetry because my first – I feel like I really learned to write, although I don't do it anymore. But as a young man, I wrote a lot of poetry. And I felt like I really taught myself how to write doing that. And I've always felt there's a link between between poetry and creative nonfiction, that they're really like cousins of some kind. Because poetry is really nonfiction, usually. Usually it's about your life. That's how I think of my work, almost as poems sometimes, if they're short enough, even though they're not in stanza form. Does that make sense to you?
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God, I've forgotten what I was going to ask you about. So, oh, yes, okay, so there you are. So now you begin to write, you decide to write Know the Night. Or did you decide to write a book? How did this begin for you? As an essay, how did it start?
No, it was, I think I had the idea that I would have, you know, what would be a collection of essays. So I had the sense of a book, but certainly I didn't have the idea as a continuous narrative until a little bit later. And then when I started combining the different threads and the different ideas, that went through so many iterations. I mean, I did a lot of research, and I wrote in a very fragmented way, and that was delightful for me because that was, you know, I was very sleep deprived at the time because I started working on the book when Gabriel was still having his sleep disorder. So, you know, I had to sort of work around him and work when I could. And so it was a very fragmented process, but I found that was sort of freeing because I had very low expectations. I thought that, you know, if I got anything done at all, then I was really doing well. And, you know, so I just, you know, went for it. And that fragmentation also sort of opened up all these connections because I could place the fragments against each other and reorganize them and see how they spoke to each other. And it was fascinating to me. So I continued my research and I did a lot of, you know, I read a lot of jazz histories and watched jazz documentaries and films and the same with polar exploration. And I also went to, for some crazy reason, the Polar Research Station center is in Columbus, Ohio. So I flew there and got to go through birds' photographs and letters and things like that, and it was absolutely extraordinary. And then, of course, you know, more that was more that I could incorporate into the book.
Yeah. And so what let me ask, when you finally finished the book, and I know it took you a bunch of years, like 3 or 4 years, did it, the whole writing,
yeah.
I think?
Yeah, the entire process from the very initial ideas to the final edits for the publisher was 4 years.
Yeah. When you finally handed that finished thing in, what had changed about you as a writer at that point, would you say?
Oh, it was a great discovery of trust. I think if you had asked me in my 20s if I trusted myself, I don't know what I would have said. The process of writing Know the Night really led me through so many unusual areas that, you know, I really had to just trust and trust all the way through. And looking back, it didn't even require a lot of effort to trust myself, that I knew what I was doing, that I would eventually figure it out. For instance, you know, I worked on the book for so long without a structure. And a lot of people, when they sit down to begin their manuscript, they have a sense of the structure. I had absolutely none. You know, like I said, I started with the idea that maybe it was essays.
Right.
But I didn't want a lack of a structure to stop me. And so I decided, you know what, someday the structure is going to come. And, you know, I worked for, I think it ended up being like more than 2 years without a structure. And so at some point I was sort of drumming my fingers going, okay, structure, anytime you want to appear, that would be just great.
Right.
But then, you know, but it did come. It did come.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say that, you know, by the time I turned the book in, it was amazing to me that trust is such a, trusting yourself is such a big part of that work.
Yeah. Oh, man. You got to, because you know how it is. Even when you're writing about your own life, even though you may say, well, I don't know how you work. Maybe you don't have a little bit of a plan, but a lot of times we go to the desk with a basic idea of what we're going to write about that day. But it doesn't matter. Once you open that file, there's what you planned and then there's what happens. And often the two may not be the same, right?
Right.
And you got to trust that something interesting is waiting for you. So, okay, so now the book is out. And before the show started, you were describing your whirlwind tour of Canada or of Halifax. Where were you? You were in Nova Scotia?
I was in Toronto and then
Toronto.
Halifax. Yes. Yeah.
All right. So how's it been for you now that you're, because this is your first book and you've published some things online and in magazines, but this is the first big experience like this. How's it been for
you?
Right.
It's been wonderful, and yes, trial by fire. Toronto,
yeah.
The Toronto Halifax tour was very packed and nutty, and the transition from, you know, writing quietly at my desk to, you know, being on live television and live radio was really eye opening. But you know, in the last 6 weeks, I've done enough public speaking that it's sort of shaken a lot of my concern about it. I guess you sort of learn how to do it or get used to it. So it's fine.
Had you done much of any of it, of public speaking, before this tour?
No.
Wow.
I'm a classic introvert.
Oh God, yeah. Poor writers, man.
You know,
I'm the unusual. I'm not an introvert. You may have guessed, but I'm not. But but I know that most of my brothers and sisters are out there. But they are forced up there behind a microphone, and they've got to do something about it. And but then there's also the experience of interacting with your readers. I assume you've had some opportunities to do that, or have most people not read the book yet?
Yes. No. I've had some wonderful responses and interactions and emails from people, and it's just been staggering, absolutely wonderful.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It really is. It's you know, I love the process of writing, but I have to say that being able to connect with readers has been really rewarding.
You know, I'll tell you, I'm a firm believer that If all we were doing is just writing in our diaries, we wouldn't need writers' conferences, we wouldn't need author to author, we wouldn't need any of this stuff. But it's the experience of sharing work with people, I think, that often disorients us and can make it very hard, just the idea that someone will like it, someone won't like it, blah, blah, blah. But by the same token, the experience of sharing it, I feel like it brings just a whole new level of meaning to it that in a way you can't really understand until it happens, as meaningful
Absolutely.
As the experience of writing is.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the book leaves you and it takes on its own life.
Yeah.
And
it's like
people
a kid.
Have right, exactly. And people have their own very particular response to it and they bring their own stories to it. So it's you know, it changes in a way. And it's really amazing to see that.
Oh, it's awesome. And so what do you think, Maria? Are you going to write another book? Are you going to write short?
Oh, I've been, absolutely. I've been working on my next one for, about 8 or 9 months.
Oh, you have? Oh, you jumped
right
back. Good for you. All right, now don't tell us about it, but how's it going? Starting it, was it a totally different experience to start it, or were you right back where you were before saying, what's the structure? What am I writing about? Is it fiction or is it nonfiction?
It's fiction, actually.
It's
fiction. And you'll notice, I mean, my memoir is very novelistic in the way it's set up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah, and this book is, I'm kind of taking it feels very different. And I've heard, you know, so many writers say that every book is completely different. But I'm starting with the same premise of just following what's fascinating to me and you know, just working through those initial early stages patiently.
Yeah. Well, go back into your cave because you know you got to pull the shades and just find what's thrilling to you, or that book will become something you don't recognize. All right. Yes, there's my little advice to you, Maria. Now, we've got
Thank
just
you.
A couple minutes left here. Yeah, I'd
okay.
like you need it. I don't think you do. But, yes, so I'd like you to finish one sentence for me before we sign off. You ready?
All righty.
Mm-hmm. It's this. If writing has – now, you actually may have already answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
Yes, I did cover the trust thing. So I guess the other thing I would say is that it's taught me the value of secrets, and both secrets that you keep and don't reveal, and then secrets that you do.
That's interesting. I've asked that question probably 100 times. That's the first time I've heard that answer. So it's taught you the value of going ahead and revealing the secret, and the power also of saying, I'm not. I'm
right.
going to hold on to it.
Right.
Oh, that is really interesting, Maria. Well, I think you've probably still got a few secrets left in you, don't you?
You bet.
I bet you do. Well, okay, so listen, this has been just great. The book, the book is Know the Night. It's on sale everywhere. Everywhere.
Yes.
And Maria... Best of luck. Best of luck with this. Just a beautiful book. Best of luck with you and your son and your husband and the whole thing. I hope it's all just awesome.
Oh, thank you so much, Bill.
Oh, you're welcome. All right. Well, we'll hopefully talk again when that novel's done.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yes. Secrets. Think about that. Secrets are good. I think Maria is very, very, very right about that, that there is an energy behind them, both in holding on and in letting go. I think she's absolutely right. Well, everybody, it's no secret that I believe everyone should write what they love, should spend time with who they love, listen to what they love, do what they love. That's the secret. Follow that, and you really can't go wrong. I'll be here next week, as always, talking to another fascinating guest. Until then, do only the things that interest you. If possible.